It's not often we take note of these intersections between social and fiscal policy. That is a...
But what about character and self-discipline? That foundation on which life flows. How have they been affected? Well, I've already said that family is the first and most important place where character is formed. It is there that the struggle to civilize children and turn them into mature adults begins and is largely, not exclusively, largely completed. And while later in life that struggle to reach maturity is chiefly an internal one, in childhood it is of necessity a struggle between parents and children. And the reason that family has survived and thrived throughout human history is that there is simply no superior substitute for two parents committed to each other and their children, providing example, discipline, and love to their offspring. Family can, of course, take a number of forms. Extended families, characteristic of agricultural and subsistence societies, the nuclear family, more familiar in modern industrialized society. But while family can take many forms, the universality of, and I quote from a famous text, the universality of a system of primary relations among people related by blood and marriage and living together for some part of their lives in social and economic dependence, the universality of that arrangement is not in any serious dispute. On the contrary, family has been the object of a great deal of philosophical and empirical study. Philosophers as diverse as Aristotle, Hegel, Burke, Rousseau, and Engels have described and analyzed family relations in great detail, sometimes to praise them, sometimes to condemn them, but never to deny their importance in understanding human development. Few have argued that there was any serious competitor to family as a framework for procreation and the rearing of children. When the family's ability to give children what they need declines, one inevitable result is that children grow up to be, on average, less well prepared to accept the responsibilities of adulthood, less able to discipline their untutored emotions, and less able to master their selfish instincts. First nature shines through the overlay of second nature much more. And while that family breakdown is a calamity for society, it is first and foremost a tragedy for those children who are thereby deprived of the main conduit human beings have traditionally acquired those character traits, or that second nature that alone makes full human happiness possible. All other possible arrangements for raising children are, on average, inferior in the preparation they give children to face the rigors of adult life, including the openness, the trust, the cooperativeness, and the perseverance necessary to succeed at work and create a family for themselves, able to confer the same benefits on their children. So having sound families and encouraging marriage means that the young Canadians who are shaped by such families enter the economy and our society better equipped to succeed there, thus raising their own standard of living and that of all Canadians. No family, of course, is perfectly loving, perfectly trusting, and perfectly supportive. They don't need to be, and no one's asserting the contrary. All that needs to be established is that, on the whole, intact families provide more of these features on a systematic basis than the chief alternatives, such as lone parenthood, serial live-in partners, government institutions, or some combination of the three. The second way in which marriage and family are related to the question of work, larger social institutions, and so on, is that marriage changes the behavior of the adults. It doesn't just change the behavior of the children. Social anthropologist David Murray has argued that the behaviors that make one a good mate and parent, diligence, competence, trustworthiness, also happen to be among those that make one a valuable employee or a successful entrepreneur. Honoring your promises is a trait one learns by observing that behavior in your parents, for example. Even if no parent is perfectly trustworthy or truthful, and even if some parents are irretrievable liars, remember that the point of comparison we are after is not some impossible ideal no flesh and blood human being could fulfill. The point of comparison is a flesh and blood human being with all his or her failings, who stays and tries to work things out, versus the one who disappears and is replaced by some inferior substitute or who was never there in the first place. Moreover, the data show that men who marry are changed by the experience. I want to reassure women, they're actually changed for the better. For example, the data are very clear. Men who are married work harder than their unmarried counterparts. Because, why? Because they have responsibilities, and a word one hardly hears anymore, duties towards their families. So the health of our families is directly related not only to how well our children succeed in the workforce, but to the examples our parents set for us by how hard they work and how reliable and trustworthy they are towards us as children. Now, I mentioned David Murray a moment ago. I'd like to quote from something David wrote. He said, males who marry and males who get and keep jobs, which are circumstances of clear advantage for child rearing, share a common foundation. They keep commitments. Such men come from common environments. They had fathers who wed their mothers. Now, this is a summary of what we know from the empirical research. Promise keeping, David Murray is telling us, is something that children learn first at home, watching how their parents treat each other. The reality is that many forms of behavior first learned at home are the cornerstone of future behavior in both the family and the workplace. And the reason this matters is that there is an increasingly common view among libertarians of left and right. Think back to the quotation from Theodore Dalrymple that I read at the beginning. There's this increasingly common view among libertarians of left and right, classical liberals and others, that whether or not to have children and whether or not to be married when doing so is a purely private decision. Purely private. Rather like what job you choose, what neighborhood you live in, and what car you drive. The state, and more importantly, society, that is to say, all of us, in the form of other family members, friends, club and church members, we have no business having any view about the childbearing and childrearing behavior of individuals. And those people who have children have no resulting claim for help or support from their fellow citizens. Having children or not is simply a matter of personal liberty. And we as autonomous individuals may order these matters exactly as we please. The decisions that we take in this regard should be treated as much as an expression of our private beliefs and values as the clothes we wear, or the books we read, or the spiritual values that we profess. If we accept, however, that family is where we learn many of the behaviors that make things like economic exchange and contracts and even democracy possible, then family becomes a matter of central importance. Promise-keeping, taking account of and even caring about the interests of others, respect for what belongs to others, trustworthiness, self-control, these are just some of the behaviors that I'm talking about. In fact, many of our political and economic freedoms are predicated on the notion of society being composed of responsible and accountable individuals who also take account of the interests of others in their actions. Self-government, in a political sense, and self-responsibility in an economic sense, take for granted a world composed chiefly of self-governing and self-responsible individuals. And the success or failure of the Canadian family is therefore, in my view, of prime concern to every one of us. Of all the character traits that children learn at home, however, one deserves pride of place. And that is self-control, what I referred to just a moment ago, as individual self-government. Another term for that is self-control. Self-control is the ability to contain current desires in the interest of achieving a more important good that takes time to reach fruition. Such self-discipline is the character trait that most separates those who will enjoy success in work, school, and family from those who will not. And it is the character trait preeminently learned at home. The classic struggle between parents and children, the thing all parents fear and all children resent, is getting the children to restrain their appetites and to think of the good of others. Children, by and large, want what they want right now. Another's toy, the attention of their mother or father, sweets, pets, television, leisure. To begin with, they have no conception of respecting the property of others, the need to respect their mother's conversation with someone else, the fact that they will be having a meal shortly, or that they have household chores, or that having an animal brings responsibilities. Parents see the value for their children in acquiring the self-control to realize these important benefits, but children rarely do, and come to see the value of the self-discipline they acquire only after they have acquired it. We're back to Aristotle again. Later, children learn to resolve their disputes through negotiation and consideration of the interests of others. They learn to be able to put off enough immediate satisfactions to succeed in school, acquire a trade or profession, be attractive to the opposite sex, avoid unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases, save for houses and cars, and the ultimate emotional investment in the future, have children and make sacrifices in order to equip them to succeed too. All of these goods are more important than immediate pleasure, but they all require the ability to set aside that pleasure to realize them. Parents are the first and most potent force teaching children that a successful future imposes constraints on what you can do and what you can have in the present. Let me qualify what I've just said. Teaching the principle of short-term pain for long-term gain is what most parents do for most children. Sometimes, this essential set of character traits fails to jump the generational divide or is never present in the parents to be instilled in the children. And that can happen for a number of reasons, many of which you can imagine. Many traditional family and community members, such as grandparents, in-laws, church leaders, teachers, sports coaches, and other role models, police, etc., played and continue to play supporting roles in this effort, but the evidence is pretty clear that they can only marginally compensate for a failure to transmit these values in the home. In any case, the legitimacy of these social supports has been badly undermined in recent years, just as parental authority and the ability to impose standards of behavior has been undermined in recent years. At the same time as the state has been reducing the cost of self-destructive and antisocial behaviors, such as teen pregnancy, juvenile crime, drug use, and idleness, it has been tightening restrictions on the behavior of parents trying to impose discipline within the home. And every one of you can imagine, can remember examples of the American tourist David Peterson, who was arrested for spanking his child in a parking lot in London, Ontario. The Quebec father who had his decision to try and discipline his daughter to stay out of internet chat rooms by canceling her camping trip. He was overruled by a judge, and then that ruling was upheld by a superior judge. We've got advocacy groups like the Canadian Foundation for Children, Youth, and the Law constantly pressing government and the courts to restrict even further the latitude that parents have to establish effective limits on their children's behavior. Too many parents and prospective parents have heard the stories of false and exaggerated accusations of child violence, resulting in charges, social and economic losses, children being taken into custody by government agencies, and the virtual destruction of family life. I remember a good friend of mine, a former president of a university out in eastern Canada, was having a dispute with her child about exactly some of these issues, and the child yelled to her and grabbed the phone and said, you know, you're not letting me do what I know. It's child abuse, and I'm phoning the police. And she said, as she rolled up her sleeves, well, I better make the best use of the time before they arrive. Given the obstacles already in the path of parents in trying to establish a calm, ordered, and safe home life, the prospect of their child not only being able to defy their authority with impunity, but being able to call in the authority of the state to prevent their parents taking the action they judge necessary for their child's welfare, can make the already awesome responsibilities of parenthood seem too daunting for mere mortals. If parents are unable to establish effective discipline, The consequences are not just terrible for the parents. I mean, a house full of undisciplined children is hell. But it's not just terrible for the parents. It casts a lifelong shadow over the chances of success for the children. So family is the first little culture, the first little society, and the first little economy that we ever belong to. And it is there where we acquire the character that largely settles whether we trust one another, whether we're worthy of being trusted, whether we're honest, cooperative, honorable, industrious, and respectful of the interests of others. Whether we succeed in inculcating these values and behaviors on a broad enough scale will settle to a large extent how free we can be, how free we can be. If we don't have self-control, control must be imposed from the outside. So, if we do not succeed in inculcating these values and behaviors on a broad enough scale, or whether we succeed in inculcating them, will settle to a large degree how free we can be and how rich we can be, collectively. What goes on in families affects every one of us, and the parents who bring up their child successfully, imbued with these values, those parents do a work of inestimable value for each one of us. Now, Dave, I'm going to ask for some guidance from the chair here. I actually have another section about family and the welfare state, but I see it's already 10 past 10. And I know that I think we had an hour set aside, so you want to wind up at 10:30, including some Q&A. So I'm thinking, we don't have time to get through all of that stuff. I will just quickly say that it's very clear that the development of the welfare state, as we have come to understand it, and as we have come to live it, has had profound effects on the behavior of adults and children. And in particular, I focus in the book, and if I had more time or if I talked faster, I decided to give you a break. I would have been able to lay out for you the extent to which the evidence is very clear that, I'll just give you one example because it's for me it's so very powerful. This is about the effect of welfare on the behavior of low-income women. Doug Allen, who may be known to several of you, an economist at Simon Fraser University, wrote about this several years ago. He noted that there was little surprise in the fact that higher welfare payments led to higher levels of dependence among lower-income women than on higher-income women, because, of course, higher-income women are not going to be tempted onto welfare. They have other sources of income. And the reward to them for working is much higher. So welfare is not an alternative for them. But for low-income women, they may well have a choice between low-income work and welfare. And so he said, indeed, statistically, this is borne out. And we had actually quite a lot of experience. I see Ken Bosenkuhl over here. Ken has written quite a lot about welfare reform in Alberta, and some of his colleagues then at the C.D. Howe Institute did quite a lot of work on the consequence of too high levels of welfare benefits and the influence that it had on our behavior. But to come back to Doug Allen and this issue of how welfare affects the behavior of low-income women, what surprised him was that, and I quote, welfare seems to have a relatively large impact on decision regarding family status, in other words, whether or not they get married. And more precisely, he found that an increase in welfare entitlement of just $100 to $200 per year leads to a 5% increase in the probability of being a lone parent. A 5% increase in the probability of being a lone parent. A 2% increase in the probability of a child being born out of wedlock, and a 1% increase in the probability of divorce. So these are just some of the empirical findings that I think drive home the notion that The welfare state has had a very large impact on our behavior. And another way in which we observe that is, think back to all the things I've said about the way the character is formed at home. That being the case, if the work ethic of children is formed primarily by watching how their parents behave, you might expect that when a welfare state is suddenly introduced into a society in which children have traditionally learned these values at home, that the introduction of the welfare state would actually not much influence people's behavior, because they would still be operating on the endowment of values that they had acquired before the welfare state, these ideas of self-responsibility, self-reliance, an obligation to work. And so the mere existence of benefits would not of itself draw them into dependence on the welfare state. But what happens is that the ready availability of welfare benefits takes about 30 years. It takes about 30 years to begin seriously to affect the work ethic of society. And I will just read you one little extract about this. One pair of researchers noted that while the main increase in tax rates, as well as in the coverage and generosity of the benefit system of the welfare state, took place between the late 40s and the late 70s, so that 30-year period, this is in the United States, clear indications of negative effects on work did not emerge until the 1980s and 90s. It took 30 years for the welfare state to overcome that endowment of values that we had here. And the rise of an extremely well-developed welfare system in northwestern Europe, for example, has been shown to coincide with a fall in values, in attitudes, valuing work as the route to success in life. Of the 42 countries in the 1998 World Values Survey, the seven countries ranking the lowest in terms of the percentage of respondents who regard hard work as a quality especially important for children to learn at home, the seven countries who least subscribed to that statement were all advanced European welfare states: Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Norway, the Netherlands, Austria, and West Germany. Were he living in Northern Europe today, my view is Max Weber, the 19th century German sociologist, likely could never have written The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, his seminal work, a work about the importance of the work ethic, self-discipline, and sacrificing current pleasure for more important future goods. The incentives associated with easily available state benefits then not only make parents less able to communicate to their children the importance of work and make children less receptive to that message, but these same incentives also lessen the power of family ties and weaken the family as the chief means of passing values and traditions across the generations. Remember that the traits and behaviors that confer success in work and life, generally speaking, are ones that must be acquired. They are second nature, not first nature. This causes tension between parents and children, because parents try to inculcate in their children values that will stand the children in good stead later in life, but those values, the importance of those values, will not seem evident to the children at the time. Children prefer present enjoyment. Parents worry about their future achievement. When children are bound to their parents by economic ties, as well as ties of affection and respect, both sides have a direct and material interest in making the relationship work. But when children can turn to the state to supply many of the things previously available only through family ties and obligations, and when the state is, as it is in Canada today, and most welfare states, when the state is specifically constrained from attaching expectations of good behavior in exchange for its aid, parent-child relations are powerfully altered, and generally for the worse. And in concluding, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to leave the last word to Edmund Burke. And in this quotation, I'm going to use the word fountains. In Burke, when he uses this word fountains, he's talking about wells, the wellsprings of life. He says, to corrupt family relations is to poison fountains, is to poison the source. To corrupt family relations is to poison fountains. For the sources of the commonwealth of society, of all of us collectively, the sources of the commonwealth are within the households. And errors there are irretrievable. Thanks.